Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Subprime loans, credit default swaps, toxic assets, too big to fail. That was the word cloud hovering over the nation when Tim Geithner took over in 2009 as Treasury Secretary. The word cloud hovering over the country today is, I don't know, 1% versus the 99, student loan debt, wealth gap. So did Geithner save the nation from total financial ruin? He has his own take in his new memoir, Stress Test. And Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for hers. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hello, Nancy. So how much did he get right, Nancy Kane, Timothy Geithner, the former Treasury Secretary?
So, you know, his new book is, Geithner's book, Stress Test, is has just literally been released yesterday. And I haven't read it.
Okay. We'll forgive you.
Forgive me. So I'm speaking from a series of lengthy interviews and reviews of this, all from the New York Times. Two of them by their Wall Street Deal book editor and writer, Andrew Ross Sorkin, and one by their kind of first-rate world-class book reviewer, Michiko Kakutani. And, you know, it sounds like a very balanced, very careful, and you know, it's not a tell-all book. It's careful, it's balanced, and you know, you read these reviews. I'm going to read the book. As soon as I finish Thomas Piketty's book, I'm almost finished.
Oh, everyone's talking about that, aren't they?
Oh, what a fabulous book.
It's your income inequality.
So I will just say as an aside for those of our listeners that are interested in very good economic books, and Geithner's may or may not fit in that category. I don't know yet. Piketty's does, and it's eminently readable. And I was surprised by that. It's very readable. It's almost conversational, and yet you can tell it's from someone who's thought very deeply and is very knowledgeable, so you have great confidence in him, as you would like a beloved, knowledgeable teacher.
Anyway, Capital in the 21st Century.
Capital in the 21st Century is the title, full stop, destined to be, I think, an extremely important book, and not unrelated to what Geithner's doing, which is trying to tell now that he's out of office, and from the gist of these interviews that he did with Mr. Sorkin, joyfully so. And he was ready to go. He and his wife wanted for him to be out of office. I think he was tired. I think it was hard work. I think they were just ready to move to a different stage in their life. And so I think this is his chance to, if you will, wrap it up with a bow. What did we do? How did it feel? Right? The opening line of the book review is, you know, what was it like to be at the eye of a financial storm? And, you know, one of the very interesting things about this book is that Geithner, like Henry Paulson, then Secretary of Treasury under George W. Bush, and Ben Bernanke, then head of the Fed, were there not just in September of 2008 when Lehman Brothers imploded, which is the date we customarily think of the very beginning of this drama. They were there all through 2007 and 2008 when lots and lots and lots of warning signs or dominoes were accumulating and falling. So, you know, it's very interesting to hear him talk to Sorkin about what it appeared like, which is we knew we were in deep trouble. The world economy was in deep trouble. And we didn't know, you know, in some cases, moment by moment, exactly what to do. The last point, the animating, if you will, I think, unstated but still very, very important thesis of the book is if we hadn't done what we did, much worse would have followed. So that is, you know, some of it we made up as we went along. We knew it was a really dangerous situation, and but for our actions, much worse would have followed. And, you know, whether readers and pundits and critics and politicians, you know, think that is a substantial and kind of, you know, sufficient explanation and justification for what would become the Obama administration's policies toward the fallout from the financial crisis, you know, is an open question. I think for Geithner, it really was the main highway. It was the major chord of the symphony. And that's probably true for Bernanke, too. We didn't know what was going to happen, but it looked like it was going to be really bad. And so we had to, in some sense, you know, use what tools we saw at the moment as being at our disposal.
Yeah, so, for example, one of the things that we had no choice but to do under Tim Geithner was give $200 billion in bailouts to AIG,
right,
and stand by and say nothing While the executives, whose company had gotten $200 billion of our money, gave themselves $200 million, whatever, in bonuses. You know, the reason I think, in my estimation, everybody wants to set the record straight. I haven't read it yet either. I'll trust your analysis once you have read it, and then I'll read what you tell me to. Is if you were to say the name Tim Geithner, you did like a concept association game, honest to God, I would say three things. One, I would say he was picked to run the Treasury and in turn the IRS when he hadn't paid his taxes. That's the first thing everybody in America knew about Tim Geithner. Number two, he gave it, and to his credit in the book, he admits the worst speech in the history of his department.
Sent the Dow Jones falling 400 or 500 points.
Here's a little piece, which doesn't sound so bad. This is February 2009, and this is when he's an attempted explanation of the rollout of essentially the Save the Economy plan of Barack Obama. Just listen to a little bit of what Geithner had to say.
Let me describe each of these three steps. First, we're going to require banking institutions to go through a carefully designed, comprehensive stress test. This borrows the medical term. We want their balance sheets cleaner and stronger, and we're going to help this process by providing a new program of capital support for those institutions that need it.
Okay, most Americans have no idea what capital support is. They don't know what a stress test is in a financial setting.
They know he sounded like he was about 12.
And his voice cracked. To his credit, he says in the book that it was one of the worst speeches. He didn't practice on the teleprompter, that sort of thing. And the third thing we remember about, at least I do, is the AIG thing. So I know you haven't read it. You just read analysis from people you trust. Do you get the sense that this is, here's my explanation after the fact of why I did the right thing, even though I will admit a few mistakes along the way? Or do you get the sense that it's an honest retelling of what the administration did? And many critics believe what they did was far more favored Wall Street, as the old tired saying goes, than Main Street.
I suspect it's the latter. I suspect that Geithner really, you know, this is all of these books. You know, they're political in nature. They have to be, right? But they're also about, you know, here's my footprint on the history of the moment, right? I'm putting my footprint down on this ground. But they're also, remember, I know this as a writer, I know this as a historian, I can't say I know it as a silverback gorilla like Geithner or Bernanke or Alan Blinder or, you know, Henry Paulson, all of whom have written books, or Michael Lewis, right, who's a different kind of silverback gorilla, who wrote, really now has written two books recently on the financial industry, Flash Boys, his most recent one on high-speed trading, and The Big Short, which has to do with credit default swaps, which were bets that were part of the falling dominoes of the crisis. Very important ethically, financially, and politically. In any event, they're always, all these people are also coming to terms with themselves at some level about what they did.
Right.
So,
of course.
Right? So, you know, doesn't have the confidentiality and the Hippocratic Oath of your therapist's office, right? And you haven't met your maker, so you're not kind of facing the real truth. But, you know, this is partly about what did I do at some fundamental level, just like, you know, every memoir.
When you said his maker, did you mean God or Larry Summers? Who are you talking
well,
about?
Well, that's a good question. Or Bob Rubin, right? All of them are important in the making of Tim Geithner. All of them have, and this to me is the most interesting thing about the book. I'll come back to the maker in a second. Rubin, Summers, right? Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner. All of them were part of the prologue to this story. Now, the prologue matters a great deal. The prologue is what happened between, say, 1996 and 2003 or 4 around government regulation in the financial system. And there were a whole host of deregulations and decisions, not just actions taken that lifted the reins of government oversight, including most famously the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was a very important piece of New Deal legislation. Remember, the analog to all this, the comparison, is Roosevelt and the New Dealers and Bernanke, Paulson, and Geithner and the Great Recession, all of whom are comparing it to the Great Depression. So Bernanke, to a lesser extent, Summers, Rubin, Geithner are all in different ways part of a series of actions that literally lift the reins of regulation. They're also part of a series of policymakers. Remember, Geithner had never worked in banking, as much as he seems to have, you know, kind of at least a fear of confronting Wall Street. And he never worked in banking. He's gone into now private equity work for Warburg Pincus, where he's going to make a gazillion dollars, but that's not necessarily part of the story. It's just interesting. He never worked on Wall Street, but he and these other folks decide We won't regulate things like derivatives. A derivative, for all our listeners, is a financial product that is a product, some kind of combination or restructuring. It's part of what we call structured finance, restructuring kind of instrument of financial, of the financial markets that allows buyers and sellers of financial products, usually financial paper, to do different things. So, for example, what we call subprime debt or collateralized debt obligations is in effect a kind of derivative. Or credit default swaps, which literally were bets on whether a bundled package of subprime mortgages, right? Those are loans to housing buyers that have poor credit ratings, bundled together, supposedly in thoughtful, good ways that make this bundle less risky than any single one of those mortgages would be. Those were in the bets that were placed on them in the form of something called credit default swaps. I bet that bundle, you know, Goldman Sachs is actually going to go bad, and Goldman and someone else buys a in a sense sells that to you, saying, "I bet it won't." Right? Literally, just to put the record straight. At one point in 2007, there were $62.5 trillion worth of credit default swaps, completely unregulated. There is no reporting requirement, and this is a derivative on these financial instruments. So, and by the way, $62.5 trillion is about what household net worth was in the middle of 2007, just to give you a benchmark.
Wow.
So these men were part of a series of policy decisions, including decisions to do nothing about huge, fast-acting, fast-developing financial innovations on Wall Street and all over the world.
So the men essentially who were charged with fixing the problem
helped create the problem. They're not helped create. This isn't a government. As Lewis writes so well, and lots of other very balanced people, it's not just about government. It's about a whole bunch of mostly male silverbacks on Wall Street and on Main Street selling loans to people. Mortgages that have no business getting loans, right? It's about all kinds of folks in the middle brokering those packages of loans and selling off to Wall Street. And let's not forget the credit rating agencies. For those of us that don't remember their names, Moody, Standard & Poor, and Fitch's. These were people that the SEC had designated to say what is a AAA asset. Remember, a lot of institutional investors like pension funds, like CalPERS, the California Pension State Pension Employees Fund, can't invest in anything that's below a certain grade. Well, who designates whether that bundle of mortgages is a below-grade investment bundle or an above-grade? Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch's. There's just a small rub here. Moody's, Standard & Poor, and Fitch's all get paid by the same banks that are issuing the securities, right, that are in these bundles. So there's just a wee conflict of interest.
Sounds
here.
Like the FISA court to me. Is
yeah,
what
so stay
like.
With me. So the point is that we have a drama. It's a Shakespearean drama. It involves, to a real extent, you know, people who had no business and knew they had no business buying mortgages. It involves a bunch of people along the value chain making money on those mortgages. It involves Wall Street, which in some sense at some huge high level knew that the banks, they themselves were too big to fail, so would take incredible risks. By the way, Goldman Sachs knew as early 2007 that all this stuff was crap, all this debt that they were, and they were shorting it. They were betting that its price would fall even as they were selling it to institutional investors, right? And Lloyd Blankfein's defense of that is we have very knowledgeable institutional
And the reason
investors.
Nancy just pointed me when she said Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs, invited, despite what right. happened here, to the first state dinner by the President of the United States.
Last comment. So no one's. This is a complicated drama,
yeah.
But it has. I've mentioned the biggest players. So to me,
well, you also have one person you haven't mentioned who he. I wouldn't say he exhibits contempt for, but clearly no love for, is a woman who actually believes in government regulation and those sort of things. Our own Elizabeth Warren. She is not portrayed in a wonderful way in this book by Geithner.
No, and he's, you know, sorry. So anyone that's in the position he's in, right, where they're part of the prologue, and you got to think about how he talks, the meetings he has with himself about that, right? He, Summers, others, the meetings they have with themselves about how they get right about that. So, you know, big mistake. Right. So he's part of the prologue. Then he and Hank Paulson and Summers and a few other, well, particularly Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, are sitting here as the world that they know and that we all depend on all over the globe, you know, faces a kind of Armageddon. And so an insider's view of that, I think, in itself makes a reason to at least pick up the book. And there's clearly, right, that kind of perspective that at least the first, you know, 40% of the book is, you know, the fall of 2008.
Well, you know, there's a section in this book where he talks about comparing the emotions he had. He wasn't obviously a soldier, to the Hurt Locker, and how he was so worried about catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
And the Hurt Locker, people remember, is when the guys were going up to defuse the bombs, how he thought it could have just ended in complete and utter failure. So it hasn't at least ended in complete and utter failure.
No, well, not at all. And I think that's very important. Right? Again, I start off with my adjective was balanced, right? This is too complicated a story to fit in one dark or all-white folder, folks. Whatever you think about Geithner, whatever you think about, you know, Wall Street, it's too complicated. We all depend on Wall Street, incidentally. So, but one of the interesting things, right, is that think about it. Let's recall. I remember standing at HBS watching the Dow Jones fall on my computer the day that what was the beginnings of the financial bailout plan failed, and the Dow falls 700 points in a couple of hours. We thought the world was going to end. And what these guys were trying to do at some very fundamental level is, and it felt like that, was stop that. So let's not forget it.
I'm out of breath.
I don't know what any of this stuff means, of the swaps and the derivatives.
You know my favorite part we didn't get to? I was afraid she was going to ask us. You know my favorite part is
what?
He'd walk into a meeting with Larry Summers, who was advising the president, and say, is this a real meeting or a fake meeting? My favorite part. Nancy, great to see you.
Okay. Nancy joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, as always, that was great. And it was great for you guys to tune in for another edition of Boston Public Radio tomorrow. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan and the Boston Globe's Brian McGrory. Our show's a production at WGBH. Chelsea Murs, Will Rose, Amanda McGowan, John Parker, our team. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.